Patrick Donovan and Anthony Albins both work for the Office of Catholic Youth Ministry for the Diocese of Wilmington. In September of this year, Anthony and Patrick traveled to Africa with Catholic Relief Services, and they're here this morning to tell us about that trip. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Bob.
First of all, what was the purpose of your trip?
Every year, Catholic Relief Service takes youth ministry leaders from around the country to different places in the world so that they can visit and experience firsthand the work of Catholic Relief Services and then come home and give witness to that ministry. They also repeat the process for seminarians and for high school religion teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So we were part of the Call to Witness program for 2004, which was originally scheduled for Pakistan and then rescheduled in September for Rwanda.
So what you were with a large group or...
We had six folks from around the country, different folks. We had one, for example, parish coordinator youth ministry from Virginia, from Arlington.
Mm-hmm.
The other folks had different roles in diocesan offices. Some were diocesan directors. Some worked in archdiocesan offices. So a variety of backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Where did you go and what did you see?
We traveled to Rwanda and visited a couple of Catholic Relief Services work sites. Anthony and I were assigned to the Diocese of Chungugu, which is the southwest corner of Rwanda. Some of our colleagues were sent to the Diocese of Butare and then another diocese in the northern part of the country. And the purpose, really, in our parish visits was to see firsthand what the parishes were involved in. We visited with not only the Committee for Justice and Peace, but also one of the United Nations and Caritas, the Catholic Relief Service in Rwanda, partnership for a refugee camp with refugees from the Congo that had been there for several months and actually were getting ready to be transferred to another site, escaping the violence in the Congo. We also visited several of the parishes, several of the genocide sites. The parish where we were stationed is the site of the murder of 6,000 people.
Mm.
They took refuge mostly in the church and around the church and who were slaughtered there on the promise on the premises and stayed there. The bodies and whatnot stayed there for a while. In throughout Rwanda and throughout the 90 days of the genocide in 1994 when nearly a million people were killed, it took a while for several months, and in some cases a little more than a year, for the people of Rwanda to come back and reclaim their churches. So this is a church that was reclaimed by the people in the area of Chungugu, in the Shangi Parish, and there is now a mass grave next to the church, a stone's throw from the church, and a memorial there. So that's really kind of a glimpse of what we did.
Is everything that you experienced in Rwanda, was it all kind of based on that period in the mid-90s of the genocide? I mean, is that kind of the focus of your trip?
Well, I think that...
I mean, it's hard
yeah,
to go about
I know what you mean,
daily life without mm-hmm. that having to be the everything mm-hmm. reflecting upon that.
Well, I think by the view of the outside world, in many respects, that's really the complete picture of how they define Rwanda in reality. And a lot of what we did see were so certainly very significantly influenced by that.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was colored by the fact that this was a response to or a result of the genocide. But I think what was great about the experience is that was certainly a big part of it, and that was a very inescapable reality, as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what was also important was that we were able to see the good work of the church, the good work of Caritas, the good work of CRS in the country, and how they're not just rebuilding and rebuilding relationships, rebuilding physical infrastructure, but how they're moving ahead and looking towards a new reality that is a unified country, a country that hopefully will be without tribal divisions, internal divisions, and they're very intentional about that. So I think that was, for me, that coming away from it, I think the genocide certainly was a major, major influence, but it was nice to see, it was very reassuring to see that there was certainly more than that.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's certainly not on the scale of the genocide, in the United States there is a pre-9/11 and a post-9/11 world. And talking to the people of Rwanda, there is a pre-genocide and a post-genocide. They are living every day under the fear that this could happen again. I mean, this was in part planned by the government.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about it, if you would. What exactly happened?
Well, we recommend, first of all, a great book. If the listeners are interested in finding more about the genocide, there is a wonderful book called "We Write to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed with Our Families," and the subtitle is "Stories from Rwanda." And if you simply do a search for about Rwanda and whatnot, you'll find that on any website or in the bookstore. April 15th, 1994, the president of Rwanda and the president of Burundi were killed in an airplane crash. Their plane was shot down in Rwanda. And I spoke while we were there with a woman who watched the plane go down. And as the plane crashed, 15 minutes later, people were being pulled from their cars and killed, Hutus against Tutsis. And as they were being killed, the Hutus, killing the Tutsis, were saying, "You killed our president, you killed our president." Well, nobody knew that the president was dead at that point. Mm-hmm. The whole thing was so well orchestrated and so well planned. And if you read in the book, they talk about how they saw this coming. This was not the first genocide in Rwanda in 1994. There were other smaller genocides in the 50s and the 60s and even farther back. The designation between the Hutus and the Tutsis may at one time have been a tribal distinction, but more recently it was a distinction that the government imposed on the people based on how much money you had, how many cows you owned, how much land you owned, all of that kind of stuff was your distinction of whether you were a Hutu or whether Tutsis. This was not these are not two people who live separate lives. These are not two communities that live separate lives. The Hutus were married to Tutsis. Tutsis babysat for the Hutus. These were families that lived together, worked together, played together constantly. So for suddenly there to be this incredible animosity towards one another, such that a mother is told, "Kill your children because they're unclean, because they're of a mixed tribe," is unconscionable in our minds. It was the underpinning of society. It was always underlying there for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
But what basically happened is that there was the systematic extermination, for lack of a better word, of the Tutsis within a 90-day period. It ended. The liberation is celebrated on July 4th, coincidentally, and nearly a million people were killed. The United Nations, the general on the ground for the United Nations, begged for more troops, he said he could stop it. He said he could, interestingly, the number of troops that were sent in to evacuate the essential personnel is the number of people that would have taken to stop it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So the Western world really didn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And even when President Clinton went in the late 90s and apologized for the lack of... he was not well received by the people because in their darkest hour, no one did anything.
Mm-hmm.
So finally it was a rebel group of forces that were able to overtake the folks doing the killing and bring peace.
And now they're together, correct? And there's
now if you ask someone, "Are you a Hutu or a Tutsi?" Their response is, "I'm a Rwandan."
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How did they get from that, from point A to the point that they are now, from killing one another to living in peace and forgiveness?
It's interesting you mentioned that, because one of the experiences we had in the local parish in the Shangi area in the southwest of the country was where we were able to sit in on a meeting or a presentation by the Justice and Peace Commission, which is a very integral part of the structures there within the individual diocese. And you know, Patrick and I were commenting on this afterwards, that it's amazing that these folks are sitting together in a room, frankly folks who are from the different backgrounds, including a gentleman, for example, who was imprisoned as a genocidaire, as they were called, one who perpetrated or allegedly perpetrated a genocide act. And it came out that the reason, for example, he was not in prison was that there was no one around or no one left to testify against him. So take that as you will. But, I mean, to be sitting in a room with these folks who literally, not that many years ago, literally could have been killing each other, and now they're working to dialogue and to build community and to build nonviolent, peaceful conflict resolution means. It's pretty amazing. It's an incredible mind shift, and I have to wonder in our society or the Western world in general if we'd be able to make that shift if we were in the same position in such a short period of time.
Has the church had a big hand in that shift?
They have in and through the work of Catholic Relief Services, who never left. They left geographically. They left the country in part to save their own lives, but operated immediately from a neighboring country to give refuge, to give help and support. Sadly, the reputation among some in Rwanda is that the Catholic Church was also part of the genocide.
Hmm.
There are priests, there are bishops who have served time and continue to serve time because of their role in the genocide. But the general consensus is, and the general understanding is, that those are, they are few and far between. Right. And much like the crisis, in our church in the recent years, they're news because they are the exception.
Right.
Not the norm.
Mm-hmm.
But in answer to your last question, Bob, my first response is grace.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of things that we can give to the people of Rwanda. Hope is not one of them.
Mm.
These are an incredible people of hope. They are people of forgiveness. Even the Gacaca trials, which means truth, that's coming out, that they're doing in the last several years. If you are in prison and you are willing to testify to the truth, to tell, and I go back to that wonderful scene of Jesus before Pilate, what is truth?
Mm-hmm.
If you are willing to testify to the truth, if you are willing to tell what you did and what you saw and who was involved and where the bodies are buried that they're still discovering, you can go, and the community is willing to accept you back, then you can go free. Then you can be accepted back into the community. Anthony mentioned we sat in the same room with some folks. And, the frightening thing about this whole experience is the reality that it mediates for all of us. And that is, if it's possible for these people to go from killing each other to sitting in harmony and peace and forgiving each other, then it certainly is possible for you and I to forgive each other when we insult or hurt or offend each other.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that's a reality that certainly sits with me.
Well, that was going to be my next question, is how has this experience changed you, or what has had the most impact on you? Obviously the forgiveness, aspect. Anything mm-hmm. else, Anthony?
One thing for me, I know, is someone who, through my whole life, and have always been very active and engaged in politics and political discussions and like to understand and debate topics. This really kind of brought things to light in the sense that, for me, I realized that when we talk about issues of foreign policy, we talk about issues about international actions and involvement, that there are real, significant, incredible, massive consequences of our action or inaction. And to be in a place where you could see that for us as a nation, us as a Western world, if you will, where we did not act, and we had the opportunity and frankly the responsibility to, and we shirked that responsibility,
mm-hmm.
to see what can result as a result of that. It's great to debate ideas. It's great to have these wonderful philosophical conversations. But when it comes right down to it, you either act or you don't act. And if you don't act, the consequences can be just massive and unimaginable.
Mm-hmm.
But to see the folks coming back from that and the hope, hopefulness, as Patrick said, and grace is really inspiring, too.
Now, you mentioned a book, Patrick, but is there any other place that our listeners could go if they'd like some more information about either Rwanda or Catholic Relief Services?
There's a couple of sources. The first is CatholicRelief.org, which is the website for Catholic Relief Services. The other area, too, is, or will be, I should say, on the diocesan website, CDOW.org, Catholic Youth Ministry, under the Youth and Young Adult links, is going to be posting in the next couple of weeks our stories, some of the pictures, some of the reflections on Rwanda. Also, the partnership with CRS for this particular, for all the call to witness trips with youth ministry folks, is the National Federation for Catholic Youth Ministry, which is nfcym.org. And they also have links on their sites with stories from Rwanda, pictures from Rwanda, and whatnot. There is a great big world out there that, like Anthony was talking about, filled with hope, filled with forgiveness, but also filled with need. So this is certainly the perfect time of year for us to reflect on all that we have and the way we may share that with other people.
Very well said. And thanks for taking time out of your busy schedules to be with us this morning on Catholic Forum. Patrick Donovan and Anthony Albans.